Have you any special subject you'd like to deal with tonight?
Yes.
What?
Would you say something about why, in fact, there was a fall?
Mm-hmm.
Why we can't have existence, and why we can't have a world without being blinded from the total comprehension of it at the same time?
What do they say? That's a very good question. Really, it is tremendously interesting to see how we human beings got where we are. And we'll investigate it using our mnemonic hand, and you will grip the appropriate digit to remind you, preferably painfully. Use up a pinch. Let's start with a baby. A baby we will call an open sensorium. That is before its education starts. It is a feeling being before it actually begins to operate. It feels its own being. Can we be clear about each step? If you don't believe it, will you say so as we go along? Do you believe that babies feel their being before they're able to sit up, stand up, walk, kick mummy on the shins and so on? They feel the condition of their being. Is that correct?
From conception.
From conception, yes. We won't bother to go before conception yet. We'll start with the known and go from the known to the unknown. Babies actually turn over in the womb to make themselves comfortable. But before they turn over, they feel their discomfort. So, what the baby is feeling is its body. Now, it hasn't got a concept of body to begin with. It has a fact of being a body. Now, the four all has to do with the process whereby the consciousness of the baby falls into identification with the body as a separate thing. Imagine a baby in the womb, and the mother leans over too far and reduces the space and increases pressure on the amniotic fluid inside. The baby can feel it. It feels it. And what it is feeling is the condition of its body. And we put the body as such on the little finger. The reason is that the body is the smallest of our fields of awareness. Your physical body is very small compared with your zone of awareness. You're all aware that there are other beings in the room. And therefore your feeling awareness is bigger than your physical body, is it not? So we have a being centered on a body. It is feeling the condition of that body. Now, the body gets pushed about, cramped, expanded, maybe oxygenated if the mother bothers to breathe, and if she doesn't, it will be oxygen deficient, and if it's lacking oxygen, it may become ill or even die. So the baby is feeling the condition of its body. Put on the little finger the word physical body. And on your ring finger, put feeling. The feeling is of the body, and without the body, there would be nothing to feel. Now, the baby is simply feeling its body, and it does this in a kind of dream condition in which it will echo the evolution of the race in its major changes. You've all seen a caterpillar turn into a chrysalis, turn into a butterfly. And you know that this process requires that somehow the caterpillar recapitulates the condition of having been a butterfly. It remembers butterfly-ness while it's a caterpillar. It eats and eats and eats towards butterfly-ness. And then it encases itself. Now this is most important. it puts a case around itself. We might call it an island which will isolate it from interferences. And inside this case, this chrysalis, it is going to dream its way through the condition from original maggot, caterpillar, original appetite, through internal concentration, focus, self-positing, self-informing, forming within. It will dream its way through to butterfly. And when it's made butterfly, it will burst out of its case. The word psyche is Greek, and it means butterfly, and it means soul. The fundamental idea is that a human being has to be encased in a physical body and then dream its way through to a fully developed being, like a butterfly. And when its development is complete, it is said to be divinized, made divine, by its own internal process of recapitulation of a cosmic process which is everywhere identical. That is to say, it is a dreaming process in which imagination, that is appetite, formulates itself, formulates appetite, which is power, energy, into a shape that it prefers. So the baby inside, like the caterpillar in the chrysalis, the baby in the womb, is busy, very busy, and with today's scanning techniques you can see the movements of the baby, and the frownings and the twistings and the turnings and the movements of limbs. Just like you can see twitchings inside the chrysalis when the caterpillar has wrapped itself up. At certain critical points, it makes a special little jump, a quantum jump. So instead of being mere caterpillar, it jumped a little bit towards butterfly. And it does it in stages, in quantum jumps. Indefinite amounts of energy inserted. The energy inserted has a definite image with it. Now there is the baby as a feeling center, centered on the physical body. So we put the body on the little finger, and then the feeling for the body on the ring finger. And what is the next stage? On your middle finger, which you know symbolically bears Saturn, time, as its symbol, this baby is going to push itself through time by feeling for its body. And the time that it's going to put itself through is the time of its ancestral indebtedness. If it's a white child, it's going to dream white dreams. If it's a Negro, it will dream Negro dreams. If it's Chinese, it will dream Chinese dreams. It will dream through the culture from which it has derived. And this is on the middle finger, and we will call this the time investigation finger. When you feel in your body, then you begin to investigate why you feel in your body the way you feel. Now observe that when you have the body at first as a simple feeling awareness of a zone of intention. Zone of intention means zone of inner tension. It is power, it is energy, it is tensing itself in order to become from infinity a finite being. So it presses into its center, and then it begins to investigate its heredity. It dreams through all its ancestral processes and all the wonderful pleasures that the ancestors have had, sexual delights, food delights, holidays with Mitchell Moore delights, whatever they are. It dreams through them all, and she's always feeling, this one I liked, this one I didn't like. And when it likes it, it gathers it together into its focus of awareness. And when it dislikes it, it pushes it away, backwards. And it tries to push it back and down out of the way. So it gradually stores up in what is called the basal plexus, in the sacral area of the spine, all the things it doesn't want to know that it does know. This, incidentally, is the cause of low backache, or the repressed things that you don't want to know about. Now, some of the things it knows that it doesn't like, but it will have to keep an eye on them. because there could be painful stimuli, painful experiences. So it pushes these backwards, but instead of pushing them down into the sacral plexus, it pushes them up the spine, and by accumulation of the impulses pushed up, the brain grows. Out of the spinal cord, by a simple swelling process on the end of that spinal cord, the brain develops like a balloon blowing up, and it pushes it up and forwards, and records, therefore, in the forebrain, all the things it has to know about. Some things are worth chasing, some are not worth changing, but are dangerous. You must know about them. So you've got two kinds of repression. One, back and down, that you definitely don't want to know about. They're painful, unpleasant, you'd rather not look. And some others, you push them back, but you know that you have to look at them to be on guard in case they will kill you, and to look for in case you want them. So there are two movements, starting from heart level, or solar plexus level, backwards into the spine, down to repress, upwards to make you alert. All that you call your intelligence in the forebrain, all your intellectual attributes, are the products of unpleasant experiences recorded and pushed upwards to be on guard. Now, on the middle finger, time finger, you say, I will investigate all the forms of my ancestral pleasures and pains. And I will make a record of these so that I can refer to it and thus avoid in my life the things I don't want and appropriate the things I do want. Now you observe that there's a tendency here, beginning with a vague awareness of body, by focusing on pleasures and condensing, repressing pains, the pains are contracted down, and you have two kinds of identification appearing. This is the root of the fall. You now identify with pleasures you'd like, some of them consciously, and with the unpleasures that you want to avoid and know are possibly there, and then the others that are so terrible you don't want to know about them, and you push them down the spine, and you make them unconscious deliberately so that you can live in relative comfort. So on that time finger, your identification with the ancestral records of pleasures and pains becomes intensified. You're beginning a process of the fall. The fall is identification with that body as the center in which you experience pleasures and pains, desirables, undesirables. And then you move the next step. You move from the middle finger to your index finger. Your index finger is neurologically wired to the forebrain to make concepts, that is, structures which will be eternally valid. The difference between the middle finger, simple records of time events of the ancestors, and the index finger is the index finger takes all the percepts of the ancestors and builds out of percepts concepts. So we'll put temporal percepts on the middle finger, and we shall put permanent, eternal concept on the index finger. And we now conceptualize our time experience under categories of thought. For instance, you see a ball, and you say, oh, that's a ball. You see another ball, bigger or smaller, and you say they're both ball-shaped, and you thus make a concept out of percepts. You see a wire-haired terrier, and an Alsatian, and a Great Dane, and a Saluki, and you say, well, they're all barks, so we'll call them dogs. You make a concept dog out of many different kinds of perceptual creatures which have a similar kind of behavior. When pleased, the dog waves its tail. When the cat waves its tail, it's annoyed. So you make a separate category for cats and for dogs. And you put your categoricals on your index finger. And now you're really in danger of identification, because on that index finger you are going to put all that you call moral philosophical ideas, all the things you don't want to know about in principle as opposed to in time. You don't like to think of cruelty to you. You don't like to think of senseless cruelty to anybody. And you make a category. So your identification on your index finger level is very, very great. You have conceived yourself as a human. Little finger, mineral. Ring finger, vegetable. Middle finger, animal. Index finger, human. On the human, that's fourth level, you categorize all your experiences and you subsume them under various philosophical definitions, universal categories, and you build yourself a conceptual being, and now you shift your identification from the physical body progressively through the feeling, through temporal experience records, into the concept, I am a human being. Now when you do that, the category humanity, under which we subsume ourselves, becomes a dominant idea. We now identify with an idea. So we can say, oh, I got my finger trapped, I got gangrene, I had it amputated. It's gone, the finger's gone, but I, the human being, remain. Gradually you shift the identification from the physical body, stage by stage, to the conceptual body that you call human. You now have concepts of what it means to be human, to be humane, to be hierarchically evaluative. Human means hierarchical power count. H, hierarchy, U, power, man, count. When you think, oh, I've got a sense of value, I'm superior to the animals, and to the vegetables, and to the minerals, I am a human being, you're in your gravest danger of identification. And you build out of this identification a moral view of the universe in which you say, this is good and this is bad and I know it. So that after you have conceptualized yourself in that way, you progressively work internally and build up a sense of I-ness. You put that one under the thumb. The individual consciousness that I am I myself, and all I am is all this clever thing that knows the concepts, the percepts, the feelings and the body. Now we've got what we call conceptual egotism. We believe now, through the work we've done in the field of awareness, we believe that we are human beings with individual will. And we believe that this individual will is tremendously important. It's the most important thing there is. There was a good German film on the other night called The Refusal, about a fellow who was a pacifist in Austria. And he believed against everybody, against the church teaching, against everything, that he had understood Christ better than anybody else, and he would not fight, and he was duly guillotined for his belief. But he believed he was right. And he was so strong in his belief, and so consistent in his belief, that he made all the officials above him uncomfortable because they weren't so sure about their beliefs. Now this is very important. The thumb represents your will to individual consciousness. And that is your greatest danger, that you actually conceive yourself to be a separate individual conscious being with concepts, with percepts, with feelings, with body. But you, mysteriously, are this egoic self. And this egoic self is more important. Someone treads on your toe and you say, you have hurt my toe. That's possession. My toe. My toe. I am a being who owns a toe. I am prepared to sacrifice my toe for a beautiful woman or £1 million or something. Or to get my name in the paper, I will do it. But this mysterious I, place it on your thumb, the thumb that pushes the fence, the pusher. The more energy you push into that concept, I am an individual, the more you confirm the fall. Because once you have established the concept, not the reality, the concept that you're a separate being with a will, with an intellect, with time sense, with feelings and body, once you have said, these are my possessions, these four horizontals are my possession, and I'm vertical. you then create internally an image of a being that is totally independent of phenomena, that can make sacrifices of phenomena. So if you conceive yourself to be a military genius like Napoleon, you can order millions of men to go to Moscow and get their toes bitten with cold weather. And because of your strong sense of I-ness and your moral concept which you design, you can see you are thoroughly justified in whatever you do. That is the process of the fall. Now, looking at it, we started with the gross material body and worked our way up. Now, we can invert this and say that it's the wrong way. We should have done it this way. First of all, there was a will. This will was an individuated will, but it had not yet pushed itself through the resistances represented by intellect, time sense, pleasure, pain, physicality. Hadn't done that. It was a will zone in eternity. The philosophical term for that is spiritual monad. It is a one, and spirit means it's self-determinant. It is a self-determinant unity. Now, where did that come from? Our five fingers spring out of the palm, don't they? And you remember that the palm symbolizes the sixth level counting from below, and the first level counting from above for the existential being. Our individual will is simply a zone in an infinity of conscious power. Conscious power, which prior to initiating the change is not called a will, not called a unit will. Imagine that the universe is power. We know this is a fact from nuclear weapons. Matter is power. Now, from the palm to the thumb is a simple movement. The base joint of your thumb is inside the palm. The two top joints are out of it. Your basis of will rests in the universal power. Now, the fall was a fall out of the universal awareness of power, which is sentient power. A bright girl had a thought the other day. She suddenly saw, quite correctly, phonetically, that the word sphere really means sentient power here. The sphericalization is sentient power grasping itself like that. That was an intuition. It happens to be ontologically correct. And the sphere of being is an infinite power zoning itself. Z1, zone. Z means zeal. It's an infinity of possibilities in the infinite sentient power. And one of the possibilities is self-precipitation by grasping. Now, the sept in concept means grasp, capere, to grasp. So that within the field of awareness, there is a possibility of seizing anywhere in space like this. Observe the ace in the word space. Ace means spirit. Sentient power, spirit, S-P-A-C-E. It grasps the zone, and the moment it makes the zone, it is called self. Self is a zone in infinity. The infinite is pure sentient power. Now, the fall consists in putting a spherical conceptual line down a given zone, saying, I am in charge of that zone. And it's my zone, and that zone of minus, I am going to work on independently of all the other beings. And I'm going to make sure I can do it by a process of self-precipitation. I'm going to abstract from infinite sentient power a sphere. I'm going to call it a zone, a zeal one, a zealous one. You know, the Lord thy God is a jealous God. In some translations, quite correctly, it says the Lord thy God is a zealous God. The word jealous and zealous are the same. You become zealous when you're jealous, or jealous if you're zealous. You are jealous or zealous
for your own being. Now, as soon as you get the concept, I am separate from other beings, that is the fall. And it deprives you of an infinity of information beyond your definition. You now conceive yourself to be a being. The type of that in mythology and ancient religion is Lucifer. Now, Lucifer means light bearer. Lucifer, light bearer. Light means consciousness. The field of sentient power prior to creation is pure consciousness. Pure consciousness. And consciousness is power, aware of itself. So the light bearer means consciousness, aware that if it centers itself and does that, grasp itself, it makes a sphere of its own being. So the word fist, first, and Faust in the drama all mean the same thing. Faust means fist, and fist means the first grasp, and first means prince, and the Führer, the leader. All the same word disguised through various changes historically. So the first is a precipitate of the eternal. The eternal is not first. The first is the temporal series of first, and eternity is before that. The eternity is sentient power in its infinity before it grasps. And when it grasps itself, it posits itself, and it makes a asp. Now that asp is the same serpent that stung Cleopatra to death. It is an aspiring, an absolute sentient power, darkened by its own self-coverage. My hand is open, the light is on it, and then I go like that and darken it. I darken myself with counsel. It says in the book of Job, who is this that darkens me with counsel? Counsel means counting. You have said, I will be an individual. This is why the first listed crime in the universe is pride. I am an individual being, and I'm a better being than you are. If you play piano or violin or drums or whatever, better than I do, you don't really. It's just that you practice more often. I too could do that, and better. Body rich. You see, if I practice the hours he does, with my intelligence, I could do it better. And this is pure egotism, self-willed, self-precipitated, and this is the fall. Now it says about this, William Blake says of him, Solomon dumb dunce, the wise idiot. He's so wise because he says, there's no reason whatever why I should not appropriate to myself all wisdoms, all powers, and sneakily steal yours from you, and gather all your sayings, and make them mine, and then rule you. Now this is called the Luciferian error. He says, I know I can do this because intelligence, symbolized by light, is power, and I've got it. I am the brightest of all the stars. I am the morning star, I am the first star. And I am going to shine more and more and more, and everybody will be totally obscured by my relative superior brilliance. Then comes in the saying, from excess of light, darkness. When you think you know it all, you devalue the other spiritual monads, which are also ambitious individuals, and you hope that they haven't got the cleverness you've got, and you rehearse telling yourself funny stories about your own brilliance. And finally, as Orson Welles says, and he knows because he used to be a card manipulating fortune teller, you finally begin to really believe you're clever. So you finish up advertising Sandyman's port or something. The self-definition traps you progressively. Think of the man that made the film Citizen Kane, doing an ad on TV for the wine. And he should come down from that to that. Only because he was super clever knew he was, and then believed he was. When a man believes that he's as clever as he said he is, Orson Welles called him a blind seer. Now he sees and believes that what he sees is true. He's super. Once he made a film, King of Spades, and in it he had a low camera angle for him to look big and a higher camera angle for everybody else to look small. And of course the critics noticed immediately, and he got hammered for making that film. He always tried. I remember seeing him playing Othello with a 4-inch lift on his shoe. He wasn't satisfied to be big enough, he had to be bigger than big enough. Now, whenever you make yourself very super tall, it means you've got to stoop to pick the lady up. Now, if you're already short enough in the body, you don't need to stoop. Some very, very strong men are quite small. And that's a very strong man of 5 feet. And they can pick a lady up without bending down and rush off with terrible power. They haven't bothered to become very, very tall and superior. Now, it's this self-conceptualization that is the meaning of the fall. Now, how can the fall be reversed? For thousands and thousands of years, we have inherited an educational system that has stressed superiority via education and wealth, superiority of one being over another. So we have a man that goes to settle a coal dispute, and leans on a fence that breaks and he falls on his back. McGregor was a bit shocked. Yeah? It doesn't matter how big you conceive yourself to be, there is always a fact. If you're centered on a physical body, someone can throw a bomb at it. So the danger of the fall is that you forget that imposing this concept, you finite yourself, your sentience and your power. And the more you conceive yourself as champion in the physical world at a finite level of some talent, the more tied down you are by your own definition. I was asked if I would talk about the related problem, and it's this one, to do with the precipitation of conditions in the physical body of health or disease. Now, if somebody hits you very hard with a sledgehammer on the skull, the probability of fracture is very great. If somebody beats you on certain spinal levels, they can paralyze you. A blow at a certain level makes legs useless. Those things are true. But there's another thing. When you come to look at your education, you are taught to believe in cause and effect as external. Cause and effects are taught to you in science to be outside you. You know, physical science teaches you that you do not exist. You're a hypothetical observer. You can't get the scientists on the laboratory table conducting the scientific experiment. What you do is you get a physical body, put that on the table, cut that up, and you keep out of the observation what you call your subjectivity. Subjectivity there means that you react to that body on the table when you're cutting it. By identification, you don't like gouging the eye out of a rabbit to see what the rabbit is like when it's only got one eye. So you suppress your emotional reaction. All vivisection requires you to withdraw emotively from the situation. You become an abstract being. Now you're taught that in order to be scientific and accurate, you must not be emotional. You must withdraw your emotions from the situation. And if you're a boy, a child, and you fall over and you cry, somebody will say, little boys, don't cry. Now that's an inheritance from the time of the great heyday of the militarists of the Iranian persuasion, who made marvelous armies by teaching men to suppress feelings so they could kill people quite easily without being disturbed. And when you kill your feeling, you kill your sensitivity. And when you become intellectualized, so that you can actually think clearly, geometrically, mathematically, you have destroyed your feeling sensitivity. You have become like a computer program, like you can train, say, men in the army, or like the recent so-called exposure of Greek torture techniques. You can train people not to feel, not to emote, not to care, if in order to get information out of a person, they have to gouge out his eyes, electrocute his genital organs, and so on. And you can do this by practice with withdrawal, suppression of your emotion. But when you do it, you're turning yourself into an intellective machine. And you are brought up to believe that the intellect is right. When its logic is accurate, the intellect is right, and it is permissible to override your feelings. And you are taught to fear certain things, like fearing the government or the state, and you are taught to worship the said state. You are taught a host of things by suppressing your true, real feeling. You don't think when you see a famous politician telling funny stories, can't be true. And if you are of that party, you don't feel that person is lying. You know they are, but you don't feel it. It's possible to listen to a person like Enoch Powell on the colour problem and believe that he's telling the truth, although you know very well he's not telling the truth. You can dissociate feeling from intellect. And you can accept the definitions of the intellect about what is right. Fighting for fatherland or mutterland or whatever it is. You fight because you are told to, and you've been conditioned intellectually to do what you're told, because doing what you're told is right and official. Now, when you come to a field like the area of physical health, there has been for several thousand years, and I go back to the time of the ancient Greeks, when a man said there, the doctors bury their mistakes. That was a joke of the day. Imagine 2,500 years ago, that was a current joke. Now, it has been current for a long time to believe that physical conditions of health and disease are a product of external forces. Since the time of the discovery of bacteria, poor little bacteria get the blame. There's a bug going about. Do you know that? There's a bug going about. And the average GP will actually say to somebody who comes in with this, that, or the other, well, this damn patient is a nuisance, I've already seen. I know one that's got 5,000 on his book to see. How would you like to deal with 5,000 people that keep coming in? I've got this, I've got that, I've got the other. It's easy. There's a bug going about. You know? And you give them an anti-bug tablet called secretly placebo, because it's totally inert. And you are taught that you are entirely passive to the activity of bugs. Total buggery throughout. You're taught to believe this. Now, as you believe, so you tend to activate. Believing is a feeling. And when you feel that this is so, you then think in those terms. So you actually think, because you feel that you have been told with authority, this is so, and there's a bug going about. And we have to defend you against the bug, instead of saying, actually, well, are you fighting with your girlfriend? Are you fighting with your husband or your wife? Or are you in trouble at business? Is somebody cheating you, and are you annoyed? Instead of saying all these things, which an old-fashioned doctor used to say, I remember an Irish doctor from Dublin called Rafferty, and he used to say to all his patients, And what color would you like your licorice water in this week? And have you stopped beating your wife? Now he had a very large practice again, say the color they want and go out. What they really went for was advice. Don't fight. Don't be mean. Don't be greedy. Don't be spiteful. Don't be envious. He was very good at that and horribly healthy. I don't know what happened to him. I think he went away to Australia to enlighten them there because he suddenly vanished. Now, this is tremendously important. We have inside us various levels of belief. We have a belief in the physical body, don't we? In Europe. Do you believe you've got a physical body? You know very well you haven't. What does got mean? Have hold of. Have you? No? No, you see. Western philosophy has taught the separativity of the observing consciousness from the observed organism, and then progressively, since the Greek atomists, Leucippus and Democritus, right up into the 19th century, has taught that the physical atom is a real entity which you can do nothing about. And it's on that little entity the bug goes for a ride. And you have to believe it. Now, physically you believe you're a body, but scientifically you know for a fact that your body is not an entity. It is a process of energy. Now, a couple of thousand years ago and more, 2,500, Buddha said there is no egoic self. There is only a process, an energy process. There is no entity called the self. There is a process. Because when he looked inside himself, he sat with his body under a tree, which you now find out, and he looked inside the body and he found emotions. And he looked inside the emotions and he found thoughts. And he looked inside the thoughts and he found concepts. And he looked inside the concepts and he found the will to conceptualize. And he looked inside that and he found consciousness. That was all. So he said, there is no self, anatta, there is no self. There is process. And we are a throughput system, are we not? You put food in at one end and something escapes at the other end. You are a tube through which energies are continuously going, day and night. And mysteriously you have been taught to believe you are an individual, egoic, self-determined structure. Although in fact there is nothing self-determined about it. It's all reactive to pleasure, pain, thought processes, concepts, impulses of will in a field of consciousness. Now that's mysterious. That's only one level. There is. Let's take emotion. Do we know what it is? Do we like it? No, generally not. Emotions are such that if we don't watch them and tighten up on them, they'll rush away and grab something charming or bash something they don't like. The emotions are very, very dangerous. They are real forces and we tend to identify with them. An emotion can make you shake. An emotion can precipitate adrenaline and make you run about. Emotional forces are some of the most powerful forces in reality. And the control of emotional forces is the key to all that is called magical operation, poltergeist, clairvoyance, operation at a distance. It all depends on emotional fields. And they're quite different from your so-called physicality of the body, aren't they? I mean, the body, I see your body on a chair. Your emotions are not so visible. I have to examine you very carefully to see if I can see sign of emotion. And if you're civilized, you'll probably try to control it so that you don't look at if you're cynically disbelieving everybody. You don't look as if you're about to take advantage of everybody. That's your deep secret. That's another level. These are called planes or levels of being. The gross physical, then the emotive, pleasure pain. Next, the mentational. Now the mentational plane, that level of being, contains all the thoughts of your total ancestry. How would you like to think about a very, very clever three-dimensional record, like a laser holograph, and it has recorded in it everything that's ever happened to the totality of your ancestry. And that's a genuine plane of being, functionally, vibrationally different from your emotion and from your physicality. But you have another one above that called the eidetic field. The eidetic field is the same thing as the noumenal world of Plato. It's a world in which forms are mutually interpenetrating. Now in time they're not. One person sits on a chair and the person next is apparently separate. Now that's in time. But actually the formal energies of the one and of the other totally commingle at a higher frequency. So you think you're alone, but the person on either side of you and behind you and in front, they're sitting in the place with you. And in order to avoid the interference with their thoughts and their feelings and their physicality, you tighten up. I don't want to be interfered with. There's Greta. And I know that Greta's here. Oh, I must defend myself. And Greta must defend herself against me. I might be sitting in Greta's place deliberately and going, And we don't like it. So we say, I don't believe it. First, I must not believe it. If I'm going to rescue myself from psychic interference, I must not believe in its possibility. When I get my conceptual difference from Greta's a girl, and I'm a boy, I hope, and like Nureyev as Valentino, I can separate myself with the concept. You see, I got trousers, you got skirt. I know sometimes it happens otherwise. But I try to identify them. Really, girls shouldn't wear trousers except on horseback. And better if they ride side saddle in Spain and display their skirts. So I know where I stand. Yeah? Now the more concepts I can fabricate to separate me from you, foolishly, the safer I think I am. And in fact, I'm in greater danger because I have made myself ignorant of reality. Now my will, I try to believe that my will is confined to this body. If my hand moves, it's because I will it, not because Greta willed it. And there's my hand. And goes, oh, I didn't do that. Who did that? Peter Lalonic did it. He just focused on my hand and went like that. How terrible. Can you imagine? I can't afford to believe that anybody moves my body except myself. I've again increased my identification with finitude. I'm crippling myself for security's sake. I remember a matron brought me a baby 1.5 hours old on one occasion and said, I believe that you claim that you can influence babies by feeling. Is that true? She said. And I said, yes. She said, well, do something with this one. And the baby was like this. So I said, open your eyes. And the baby's eyes opened. I said, shut them, shut. I said, open it open, shut. And she suddenly said, that's the last opportunity you get to be near this baby. And she rushed out. Now, in fact, a newborn baby has the power to wake his mother up from sleep. There's a biofield relation. And today, luckily, with the aid of oscilloscopes and electrical devices, we can wire a baby up in one room and a mother in another room with no electrical connection between them of wires. And we let the mother go to sleep and the baby go to sleep. And we can watch the two screens from the third room. And when the mother dreams, her eyes flicker, the REM sign. And at that moment, the baby's eyes flicker. Oh. They're not so disconnected as we hope. Now, the more we think of this, the more terrified we get, in case John Deere there might have a deep thought, like somebody's going to come and occupy my cottage for the summer. And the idea might come into my mind. It's come into my mind. I'm lucky I'm too busy, otherwise I'll accept the offer. And the suggestion is made. And it's not only made externally, verbally, audibly, it's made secretly, emotively. And the emotive field is infinitely extended and mutually penetrates all other levels. So I can't afford to believe that there is a relation between us all. Because how do I know that my favorite thought is my favorite thought and not your favorite thought? Come, let us fly away to Paris this weekend. Whose thought was that? Mine or yours? I don't know. I'll have to sit down very carefully, and I might have to count the will. Say, no, we'll go to Edinburgh for the festival. And there is a battle going on all the time at the will level, and during sleep, so-called, everybody's communing like mad and trying valiantly to influence everybody to do everything their way. Now that is dynamic fact. So, we're trained to believe in separativity, and we know factually that separativity is a myth. Our oscilloscopes, our electrically sensitive machines today demonstrate that we are not separate, cannot be separate, but we hope that somehow mysteriously we are sufficiently separate to lead our own lives without interference. Now when we come to... Yes?
Do we have to have a fall though?
You've had it.
So it was, but could it be? Could we not actually live
without it?
Without the blindness, without losing.
Well, you can't fall without becoming blind. To fall is to do that, to grasp, and that's to overshadow yourself and to define yourself as finite.
Did it have to be that way?
It is that way.
I know, but did it have to be that way?
And when a fellow said that to Buddha, he said, that question is not enlightening. What would it be that would force you to become a fallen being? When you say, did it have to be, you're saying, is there a force that condemns beings to fall? Because if so, it is not a fall, it is a push. What's happening there is the ego is trying to extricate itself from guilt. It knows it's in a mess, and it hopes it's not its own fault. But it is. There's a very nice little story of the 30s by Helen Beauclerk, in which he wrote a book called The Love of the Foolish Angel. It's a very nice little book, and if it still exists in the library, which I suppose it does, the ladies would love to read it. But this love of the foolish angel is a love story that finishes up very nicely. In heaven, before the Luciferian revolt, there are a lot of angels, and they see Lucifer as the brightest of the lot. And one of these angels, named Tamiel, is looking, what a glorious being is Lord Lucifer. And another angel comes along and sees his admiring look and says, would you like to wear a feather for Prince Lucifer? He says, yes, so he sticks it in his hair. And then the fight begins. And all the naughties are kicked out. Michael smites, who is like unto God, he knocks everybody down. Tamiel finds himself on earth. How did he get there? Well, he got a feather in his hat that said, admirer of Lucifer. Did he know what he was? He was innocent, wasn't he? And would you blame Tamiel for accepting the feather? Remember, he's seen Lucifer, he's very bright, and he admires him. Is he innocent?
No.
So in merely accepting the feather, he's condemning himself to be treated like a rebellious angel. And he's sitting there, and a demon comes along and says, you know you have a job to do, don't you? You've got to seduce him. Oh, no, not you. You've got to arrange for the seduction of a very beautiful girl by the Lord Mayor. He's rather an obese fellow. This is your job. He said, how horrible. And after a lot of adventures and thinking, why don't you do the job yourself? Now, is he innocent? He's supposed to have the girl seduced by a corpulent Lord Mayor. And then he told him, there is a way out, you know, as long as she seduces, all right, you do the job. Now, is he innocent? It was written by a very intelligent woman. She took about 5 or 6 years to do the research into the mythology to get the story right. You see, nobody, it says it very clearly in the Bible, all have fallen short of the glory of God. Nobody is sinless. How do you know that? Because we are finite. We are in a body. We must have identified at some point.
Do we identify before conception?
You are identified the moment you're in a position where you could occupy a body.
Where you can say I.
Where you can say I.
So you're not talking about the gross body.
Oh, no, 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 no. The gross body is a very, very low level thing.
So you're talking about the four which occurs in heaven.
That's right. It's the fall out of heaven, out of eternity into time.
But that isn't when the sphere is created, is it?
Yes.
When the definition takes place.
No, when the identification takes place.
Which is
the spheres are eternal, mutually interpenetrating spheres. They're not separate.
But there's no fall in that state, is
there? No, until you identify.
And then you identify with what you believe your particular zone to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fall commences.
From the moment of identification.
And ends up being pulled into a conceptualization at lower level.
Not pulled, it drives itself in.
So when your mother and father are having sexual relations.
Yeah. You got your eye open for the opportunity.
You got your eye open for what?
For the opportunity.
So you're pushing yourself into that field of activity.
That's right, because you
those two people.
Because you want it.
Because you want it. But what is it you want?
Well,
whatever it is that's dissatisfied at the time.
Oh, the glory that you think you see.
Or the glory.
Yes, it might be the glory. My mother was a soprano, my father was a musician. When they got together, I saw an opportunity. I seized it. I can't blame them.
But you saw it.
Yes.
And you remembered it.
Oh, yes, I bothered to remember it.
But I don't remember what
I saw. Oh, you've not been interested to remember it. The whole of yoga research is a back step to remember.
So you're saying that the only difference is my lack of interest in
the... That's right. You're so busy with the affairs of this world. Like the rich young man in the New Testament. You got too much on to bother to remember about that. Tomorrow you remember. But today you're too busy. Yeah?
What is the state of remembering in relationship to the
dreaming? Dreaming? Well, in a dream, ordinarily, you are not in charge of your remembering.
When
the child is dreaming. Well, he's there, deliberately following the trail through a genetic line. He's deliberately dreaming there. Mm. He's not...
But what is the state of remembering?
The state of remembering is the straight replay of an ancestral record. As a spiritual monad, you see all kinds of possibilities. Yes. When, like all children, complain at some point to parents and say, I didn't ask to be born. My father said to his naughty children, what do you think the gleam was in my eye? They were the gleam, those children. They were the gleam. They were the one that was going to condense and say, me, I am here. That word gleam implies condensation of me, substantialization of me. Because I see an opportunity. I can become a famous being, Jack the Ripper. Alexander the Great. You know how people do it today. They read something in the newspaper, it creates a stir, and then they go out and do it again. When the Yorkshire Ripper was caught, a man rang me up and said, can I come and see you? Very important. I'm in a very dangerous state. And he came Sunday morning and said, I am the new Jack the Ripper. And he was absolutely serious. And I said, what about all the other Jack the Rippers? And he said, no, I am the one. I said, I assure you, you're not. I am as well. I said, the only thing that stops me going to jail for cleaning up the world by murdering ladies, I don't like jail. And he was very annoyed. He said, "Do you mean other people feel like this?" And I said, "Yes, they also want their names in the headlines." And he went, and you know, he's never mentioned being Jack the Ripper since. No, we only become rippers or whatever to get our names in the paper. Or to get interviewed on TV, that's even nicer. This is a Luciferian determination to be brighter than everybody else. And this is why she said the works of yogis are neither black nor white. You don't accept this good, evil definition. They supplant it with efficient, inefficient. You don't have moral categories in yoga, you have efficiencies, inefficiencies. You're freed from self-imagery. Now, when you come down from your primordial sphere, which is in infinity, interpenetrated with every other sphere, like your heat aura is interpenetrated with the heat aura of Barbara and the lady next to you. Now, it's even extending beyond Peter and Alec. It's a little bit warmer than it would be if you weren't there. Huh? That's even at the mechanical level of heat, body vibration. And biomagnetically, you are even deeper involved. Emotively, deeper. Mentationally, conceptually, volitionally, deeper still. We're all involved with each other, whether we like it or not.
Would it best then to not only accept that, but work towards positively letting that be?
That's the whole lot. If you can let being be, without egotistically pushing it, your efficiency goes up immediately. Because when you stop identifying with yourself as a finite being, you become interested in everything everybody knows. Not just what you think you want to know, but everything.
But then how do you deal with so-called efficiency?
Well, the more you know of all the people you know a lot of people. If you had all the information that they've got, available in your mind at the touch of a mental button, wouldn't you be clever? Wouldn't you be cleverer than you are? Suppose you knew everything that Barbara knows, and everything that everybody in this room knows. Wouldn't you be better equipped to do your job more efficiently?
Yeah.
I know a woman, she's called Personal Consultant in Manchester. She's bejeweled on every finger. Around her neck hangs strings of diamonds. You know why? Because she gives advice. And when she gives advice, she asks them what they are, and they tell her. She's absolutely saturated with information from her clients. There's nobody she doesn't know. A bit like Lord Goodman. You know. Yeah? So if you had all that information, you'd be clever, wouldn't you? Where would your efficiency be? Way up at the top.
Why don't I like you using the word clever?
Because you don't like the idea of using a lever. You know, clever is from use of lever. And you don't like being on the receiving end of somebody else with a lever. And the basic lever you don't like is emotional pressure. Do you like emotional pressure?
No.
That's the chief lever. Now you know Levi and Levi means left. You know the tribe of Levi are left-handed. Yeah? And you don't like to be on the receiving end of an emotive thing. You're just about to be non-emotional, clear-minded, directive, successful, and there's a female eye in front of you, and a tear rolls down the cheek, and you feel yourself wobble. Do you know why? Because your mummy used to cry once upon a time to force you into behaviour.
I remember that, yes.
I bet you do. That's why you don't like Lever.
Pardon?
That's why you don't like Lever. Because you know that you're manipulable where your emotions are not under your control. Now, supposing we revert to this medical question.
Can I just ask you something?
Yes.
You're never going to cure the problem, are you, by by endeavouring to isolate yourself from the emotional you.
No, you've got to go into the emotion and look at it. You must enter. There's a thing called Dragon's Cave, you know, in fairy stories and mythology. You know what it means? Dragon's Cave, the womb. When you're sitting in the womb and your mother has an emotional test, how do you feel? Dreadful, you can't get away from that. So you actually have to go inside the womb again, re-enter in creative imagination. And you have to sit inside there and listen to Mummy. You know, you can actually replay Mother's record.
Yes, but what was comfortable then feels revolting now?
Oh, of course, because now you're a big boy. See, the concept, the concept that I'm a big boy now.
No, I don't think it feels revolting just to have the idea of it, and the actual sensation.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
The blood supply and the actual...
All those things, yes. The reality is that you like to think you're a grown-up boy now. You're not in the womb. You're free from that. Free from emotive influence. But in fact, you're still conditioned by it.
Yes, I know.
And you still remember it. Do you know why? Because you want to be acceptable to the owner of the womb. Because you've forgotten one thing. You made your own placenta. Your mother didn't. You're a little parasitic so-and-so sitting there, gathering away at her expense. Yeah? Now, the whole of yoga is nothing but, yoga means union. And it means to re-enter union with the original pre-fall self, which you were before you conceptualized yourself as a finite individual. The preconditioning going in the womb. I've got a horrible personal interest in investigating going through wombs. I like reincarnating. So as soon as I've left this body, I'll be in another one. Quick. I'll select one with some peculiar qualities that will make it very, very interesting. It will be murderous, talented. One thing it won't be, murderous and talented, yeah, and cunning, covered up his murderousness. Yeah. One thing it won't be, and that is dull. It is very, 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 very dangerous, but good fun. No, 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 you don't get lost in the process. You remember that you came here for experience. You didn't come here to enjoy yourself, you came here to experience what it's like. So, we are imposed on by state education, by philosophies, by history, by ancestors, and we tend to believe, and we are taught to believe, that we have no control over our own organism, and that our health, quote, quote, is in the hands of some fellows who know which kind of bug it is that is going about. So we lose our initiative. We forget that we are a zone of consciousness, that we have a will, that we can design a concept and extend it linearly in time and model emotively our body. So we can kill ourselves or resuscitate ourselves entirely by a process of self incarnation, self-embodiment by deliberate conscious act of will.
And each time you do it, presumably you get nearer being consciously aware of it.
Yes, yes, yes.
Evolution.
When you said that, you stroked your nose downwards like that.
Yeah.
Do you ever watch famous people on TV fiddling about with their noses?
Yeah.
Have you noticed them?
Yeah.
When they become embarrassed, they touch the nose. The reason for that is that the nose is the oldest of our sexual discriminating organs.
The what?
The oldest of our sexual discriminating organs. You hunt on the nose. you know, the sexual partners in the animal world and in the human world. And it is nervously wired, like acupuncture meridians. That thing is wired to your genital organ. So when you feel a little threatened by an idea, you go like this. And if you felt that you were being flattened by something, you go like this and lift it up. And if you think you're being too conceited in public, you pull it down like that. And if you're on the side issue, you suddenly thought of something there that nobody knows about except you and she. You scratch it on the side like that. And there's a whole map of nosery. You know that lovely finger beads called the nosery? You can actually tell by the structure of the nose, it's in three parts. That part belongs to the eyes, this part here where the bone finishes belongs to the lungs, and this part here belongs to your belly. Just like your eyes have got top lid, bottom lid and space between. And your face. The eyes belong to the intellect, the nose to the chest, the mouth to the belly. Everything about us is threefold in that way. So that you're constantly giving yourself away. What's the French for this organ? Yeah. Are there any frogs in the house? What is it? It's a word that means counter. Yeah? It means a counter thing. Spell it M-E-N-T-O-N. You know that means? Counting crucified serpent. That Monton there. Unconsciously go chatter, 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 chatter. That's why it's called that. Now, your whole face and your being is a map. If you were in the Pacific Islands, there's a whole vocabulary of eye positions. Donald McLeod, the other lunchtime, was explaining to a young man that in order to make the Japanese businessman feel flattered, you go, when he says something, you go, suck the air between your teeth as if totally astonished with his brilliance. And it's part of Japanese etiquette. You must do it. Did you really do that? There's a host of languages known all over the world. And we're giving ourselves away perpetually by the way we sit, the way we lounge, and so on. You know that new babies often lie with their legs apart and their hands apart and go to sleep. You know, it's very hard for an adult to do that because the adult is closed. He's defending himself. Everything we do, I think, dyno, kinetic, structure, three things. Power, motion, form. Dyno, kinetic, structure. Everything we do, everything we are, is a giveaway to a sharp observer. How do you feel if you think it's true that everything about us is a giveaway? You don't know how to put your bits and pieces, do you? There was a great big muscle man who came on a pebble mill thing. I was having a drink of something, what was it? Some vegetable drink, I don't know. And there was a great big muscle man, 17 and a half stone there, showing his muscles. And the other guest was a girl. And when this muscle man sat down, she went... She'd forgotten all his muscles. She wanted to see what he'd got that made the muscles worth it. And she couldn't stop doing that. Because the more she looked, the less she saw. And yet, 10 whites of eggs, and after 3 hours, he'd had a chicken and something else, and after 3 hours, 10 whites of eggs again, and that's why he was so big. And he was asked, how did you get like this? Did anybody help you? And he said, yeah, Mum. And the girl went, see? He was a big baby. Now, it's concept, isn't it? Do you know how he got like that? He had a concept. When he was little, some other little boy pushed sand into his face. He thought, I will not tolerate this. I will eat 10 eggs, and then 10 eggs, and then 10 eggs. Until he dare not do this with the sand. That's self-conception, isn't it? We have, first of all, a field of awareness. Then we have a will to separate ourselves from the interpenetration of all the other beings. And then we design a concept. I'm a Napoleon. I'm a Beethoven. I'm a something. There's one thing I am not, and that's a nothing. And there are a lot of people that believe in reincarnation. And they've all been queens and kings and chief ministers and brave heroes. I never found one that was the reincarnation of a chambermaid in the Midlands. Right. Now this is the enemy, self-conceptualizing. This is this is the fall. And think what you've got to do. Now remember this. All nature is impulsive. Yeah? Everything we do is with an energy input. The energy is quantized. So it takes a definite number of energy quanta to form a habit. Now suppose you form a habit carelessly over 20 years. Carelessly, luckily. How long will it take you to put the same number of energy impulses into balancing? But not carelessly, but deliberately.
Not very long.
Not very long. See? Now that's called Vajrayana. Thunderbolt yoga. You say, I was sloppy, I fell into identification. Think of the church and Samuel Butler saying, I can only forgive the church its degeneration when I remember with what infinitesimally small steps it fell. Each step was so little it was hardly noticed. And it was all careless until finally the church was emptied. It could have been kept full by telling the truth deliberately. Because the truth is that religion is true. Real religion is truth. And it's useful spiritually, psychologically and physically. But it got forgotten bit by bit. Now suppose you say, how about the southern school of Japanese Zen? I'm going to enlighten myself now, no waiting. Just be a barber in Manchester. Nearly absolutely evident. And it said, Murray's, 10 barbers, no waiting. See? And that was Vajra stuff, Thunderbolt. If you guarantee, if you went in there for a haircut, a lot of people had gone in there to get a haircut because there was no waiting. It was full. And the only person with a smile was Murray. Murray was a personal friend of mine. Now, he met in this situation. You can do it now, immediately, without waiting. But to do it, you have to gather as much concentration of energy quanta as you dissipated over the years since you were conceived. Now, luckily, in those days, you were very careless, weren't you?
Yeah.
But now you're not, are you?
Not quite.
Not quite. Now you gather yourself together now and say this. All laws, all orders, all states, nations, all structures, whatever, are ego defenses. Can you see it?
Yeah.
Good. Said all states, established institutions, organizations, they're ego defenses. Yeah? Now see them all. Category, yes. All structures are ego defenses. Right, what's the opposite to order? Chaos. I now commit myself to chaos. Anything can happen. With tremendous courage, I commit myself to chaos. Can you do it?
Yes, sir.